Welcome to Akatra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI.
Hello and welcome. Today we're doing a deep dive into a truly remarkable novel, Kiran Desai's The Inheritance of Loss, which, as many of you will know, won the Man Booker Prize.
A very deserving win, too.
Absolutely. Now, Kiran Desai, she's an Indian author, daughter of the equally celebrated Anita Desai, and she has this fascinating multicultural background, India, England, the U.S.
And you really feel that in her writing, don't you? That sense of being between worlds.
Definitely. She's known for this beautiful lyrical prose, these big sprawling stories, and she really engages with huge themes, post-colonialism, globalization, identity, all that complex stuff.
And she won the Booker for this novel when she was just 35, which is pretty incredible.
It really is. So the heart of this book, The Inheritance of Loss, it's right there in the title, isn't it? It's exploring what gets passed down.
But not wealth, not heirlooms. Mm-hmm. It's loss.
Exactly. Loss of identity, of culture, dignity, that feeling of belonging somewhere. Mm-hmm. It really asks how people cope when they feel like outsiders everywhere.
A feeling many people can probably relate to in different ways.
For sure. So our mission today is to really explore the whole story, look closely at the characters and how they change, unpack those central themes, and just appreciate Desai's craft. Let's start by setting the scene. Where does this story begin?
Okay, so picture this. It's the mid-1980s. We're high up in the Himalayas near Darjeeling in a town called Kalimpong. It's misty, sort of atmospheric.
Right at the foot of Mount Kanchenjunga. Beautiful, but maybe a bit isolating.
Very much so. And at the center of it is this house, Cho or You. It's seen better days, definitely dilapidated, kind of forgotten.
And it serves as more than just a house, right? It's symbolic.
Oh, absolutely. It's like a metaphor for this world stuck between its colonial past, fading but still present, and this really uncertain, quite turbulent future.
So who's living in this decaying symbol?
Well, inside Cho Oyu, we find our main characters living in what you could call a very fragile kind of peace. First, there's the judge, Jamuhai Popatlal Patel. He's retired, very bitter, quite isolated.
The one who tried to become English?
That's him. He spent his life trying to erase his Indian roots, adopting this very stiff, anglicized way of being. Then there's Sai, his granddaughter. She's a teenager, orphaned, and she feels culturally adrift, you know, longing for connection. And holding things together, in a way, is the cook. He's incredibly loyal. His whole world seems to revolve around serving the judge and the household.
So a retired judge, his granddaughter, and the cook. A strange little household living in this precarious peace, as you said. What disrupts it?
Well, two things, really, and they intersect quite powerfully. First, you have this very tender but also sort of forbidden romance starting up between Sai and her tutor, Jain. He's Nepali.
So crossing class and cultural lines right there.
Exactly. And then at the same time, the whole region just explodes. There's a violent insurgency by Nepali-speaking Gorkhas demanding their own state, the Gorkhaland movement.
Right. I remember reading about that period. Intense.
It really was. And this uprising exposes all these deep-seated ethnic tensions, class conflicts that were probably simmering under the surface all along.
So Desai throws these very personal stories, the romance, the household dynamics, right into the path of these huge impersonal historical forces. What's the effect of that?
It's incredibly powerful. It shows that you can't escape history, you know? No matter how isolated you think you are, these bigger political and historical currents shape everything, your relationships, your identity, your future.
Their personal inheritance of loss gets tangled up with a much larger collective one.
Precisely. The legacy of colonialism, the fight for self-determination, it all impacts them directly and very personally.
It's fascinating how each character seems to embody a different facet of this inheritance of loss. Mm-hmm. Let's dig into them a bit more, starting with the judge. Jamuhai Patel.
He's such a complex, tragic figure. We get these flashbacks, you see, to his time as a student in Cambridge. He was brilliant, apparently, but utterly terrified.
Facing racism?
Constant racism, humiliation. And it made him internalize this deep, deep shame about being Indian. So he tries desperately to become English, completely rejecting his own culture.
And that had devastating consequences, particularly for his wife.
Oh, absolutely. He was incredibly cruel to his young wife, Nimi, precisely because she represented the Indianness he hated in himself. So by the time we meet him in his old age, he's just hollowed out, living this rigid, lonely life. His only real companion is his dog, Mutt.
And the political turmoil sort of forces him to confront the failure of that whole life project.
Exactly. It shatters his illusions.
It's such a powerful portrayal of that post-colonial identity crisis, isn't it? the damage done when you're caught between cultures, trying so hard to assimilate into one that you end up destroying your connection to your roots and ultimately yourself.
Yes, Desai really shows that it's a path to deeper alienation, not belonging. He ends up culturally homeless, emotionally sterile, just full of resentment. It's the scar tissue of colonialism right there in his psyche.
And then there's Sai, his granddaughter. How does she fit into this?
Sai is quite different. She's orphaned, yes, and she's sensitive, intelligent, and really just craves love and connection. But she's been raised very westernized convent school, then living with her Anglophile grandfather.
So she's disconnected from the local community, too, in her own way.
Very much so. She lives in this sort of bubble. Her romance with Jayan, the tutor, seems like it could be a bridge, initially, a way to connect across those divides.
But it doesn't turn out that way.
No, her journey is really a coming-of-age story, but a harsh one. Her innocence gets shattered as she's forced to confront the realities of identity politics, her own privilege, and the violence erupting around her. She inherits that loss in a very direct, painful way.
And that relationship with Gyan, it gets caught right in the crossfire of the Gorkhaline movement. How does that specifically show the clash between, say, personal feelings and these bigger social forces?
It becomes a casualty, plain and simple. Desai uses it to show how even genuine affection can be torn apart by political conflict and these ingrained social inequalities. Sai's background, Gian's search for dignity within the movement, it creates this gap that love just can't bridge.
So love isn't enough to conquer history, essentially.
Not in this world, no. It's a harsh lesson.
Okay, let's talk about the cook. He's unnamed, which feels significant.
It is. He represents that often invisible, subservient lower class. He's gentle. His whole life seems dedicated to serving the judge, a life of quiet duty.
But he has his own inner world, his own dream.
Oh, absolutely. And they're all focused on his son, Biju, who's gone to America seeking a better life. The cook lives vicariously through Biju's imagined success.
But reality catches up.
Slowly, painfully. He starts to understand, through letters, the hardship Biju is actually facing. And then during the insurgency, the rebels humiliate him, strip him of his dignity. It's a slow, crushing disillusionment.
His quiet suffering really highlights the themes of class and power, doesn't it?
Yeah.
What does his character reveal about the burdens carried by the marginalized?
Well, it exposes how universal exploitation is. He navigates his low status constantly, but his hope, his love for Biju, is immense. Desai contrasts the judge's sort of existential angst with the cook's very real grinding struggle for survival and dignity.
And his dreams for Biju show that generational hope pinned on migration, often without knowing the real cost.
Exactly. Which leads us perfectly to Biju himself. He's the parallel protagonist, really.
And his story is grim.
It's harrowing. A brutal depiction of life as an undocumented immigrant in New York. He's completely trapped in this cycle of exploitation, awful kitchen jobs, terrible pay, constant fear.
A ghost in a foreign land, as Desai puts it.
Yes. Just moving from one degrading situation to another, it's a total demolition of the American dream narrative. It's loneliness, poverty, despair, a real reverse fairy tale.
So it's a powerful critique of that whole illusion of the West. What does Biju's experience tell us about globalization?
It strips away the romance. Desai shows the harsh reality, the exploitation, the racism, the profound isolation. It highlights how globalization can create new kinds of displacement, trapping people between the world they left and one that won't truly accept them.
A different kind of loss of belonging.
A very sharp, modern kind.
And finally, Jan, Sai's tutor. He starts off seeming gentle, intelligent.
Yes, and he's clearly captivated by Sai, by her world, which seems so much more sophisticated than his own. But underneath, he's deeply insecure about his own status, his Nepali background.
And the Gorkhaline movement offers him something.
It offers him an identity, a sense of belonging and purpose that his relationship with Sai, who represents the class structure he resents, maybe can't provide. He gets swept up in the fervor.
So his radicalization comes from that personal insecurity.
Largely, yes. It's a political journey fueled by personal vulnerability, and ultimately, it leads him to betray Sai and her family.
That intersection of the personal and political again. How does his story show the tragic results when that yearning for belonging gets tangled up in political extremism?
It shows how easily those personal vulnerabilities can be exploited by larger movements. Guyan's search for identity gets channeled into something that demands terrible choices, blurring the lines between loyalty and political conviction. It leads to immense regret.
Okay, so we have these characters, each carrying their own burden. How does the plot actually bring these threads together? How does Desai weave these stories across Kalimpong and New York.
She does it brilliantly, layering the narratives. It really kicks off with that first act of violence, the Gorkha insurgents raiding Cho Oyu, humiliating the judge, stealing his guns. That punctures the bubble.
The catalyst.
Exactly. And from there, Desai cuts back and forth. We see Sai and Gan's romance budding, those tender moments on misty paths, sharing books. But it's always set against the escalating violence of the Gorkhalan movement. Protests, strikes, blockades cutting Kalimpong off.
And meanwhile, in New York,
we get these stark vignettes of Bijou's life. Sweaty bakeries, greasy kitchens, sometimes even glimpsing luxury from the service entrance. Always exploited, always lonely, dealing with racism, even from other immigrants. His only link home are these letters, which become less frequent.
And the flashbacks are key here too, right, to understand the inheritance.
Absolutely crucial. We see the judge as a young man in England trying so hard to fit in, facing contempt, and we see his awful marriage to Nimi, how he crushed her spirit because she was too Indian for him. This explains the bitterness, the emotional void in the house.
It lays the foundation for the loss everyone else inherits.
Precisely. Then comes the real turning point in Kalimpong. Yen makes that fateful decision.
The betrayal.
Yes. Torn, he tells the rebels about the judge's hidden valuables. This leads to a second raid, much more brutal. The house is ransacked, and the cook is deeply, personally humiliated. That's the end for Sai and Gan. Irrevocable.
And the political situation just keeps getting worse.
Yes. Life at Cho Oyu basically collapses under the chaos and deprivation.
And what about Bijou? Things go downhill for him, too.
They really do. He gets cheated out of his savings. His dream of maybe opening a small business evaporates. He finally makes the desperate choice to go back to India.
But even the journey home is fraught.
Oh, yes. He gets robbed during a layover, loses everything he managed to scrape together. He arrives back literally with nothing but the clothes he's wearing.
So how does it all resolve? Does it resolve?
Well, not in a neat Hollywood way. It's more of a quiet, almost somber convergence. The Gorkhalan movement sort of fizzles out, leaving behind destruction and bitterness. Yain has to live with his shame.
And Bijou and the cook.
That's the most powerful moment, perhaps. Bijou, penniless and broken, walks up the mountain road. He meets his father, the cook, and they just fall into each other's arms and weep. No words needed, just this raw shared grief and love.
Wow. I'm back at the house.
Sai and the judge are left amidst the ruins. They've lost pretty much everything tangible, but maybe a new, fragile understanding is starting to form between them, acknowledging their shared brokenness.
So definitely not a happy ending. What kind of resolution is it then? What's the feeling Desai leaves us with?
Yeah, it's deeply melancholic, I'd say. There's no triumph, no real victory over circumstances, but there is endurance. There's the enduring power of human connection, even if it's forged in shared loss. It's about finding a way to just continue together after everything.
It suggests resilience isn't always about overcoming, but about enduring, perhaps?
I think so. It's a very realistic, maybe even bleak view.
Yeah.
But there's a kernel of hope in that connection.
Desai's writing style itself is such a huge part of conveying these complex ideas. Let's talk about the key themes and how her techniques bring them out.
Definitely. We've touched on them, but let's crystallize. Post-colonial identity and cultural alienation is huge. You see it in the judge's self-loathing. Sai's confusion, that feeling of being caught between worlds.
And globalization, migration, and the illusion of the West Bijou story is the prime example, dismantling that American dream myth.
Right. Then there's the intersection of the personal and the political, how the big historical forces crash into individual lives, like with Sai and Guyan, or the judge's past shaping his present cruelty. You can't separate them.
And class, power, and injustice runs through everything. The judge-cook dynamic, the roots of the Gorkha uprising, Bijou's exploitation in America.
It shows these power imbalances are everywhere, just maybe taking different forms. And finally, underlying it all is that search for belonging and home. Everyone's looking for it in England, America, a political movement, love.
And the suggestion is maybe home isn't a place.
Maybe it's just those fleeting moments of connection, yeah.
And how does she use language and structure to make us feel all this?
Well, her use of a third-person omniscient narrator is key. It lets us dip into everyone's head. Judge, Sai, cook, Bijou, creating this incredible empathy and understanding, even for difficult characters.
And the structure isn't linear, is it?
Not at all. It's fragmented, jumping between present day, flashbacks, Kalimpong, New York. This non-linear structure really emphasizes how the past weighs on the present, that idea of inheritance.
She uses a lot of symbolism, too, doesn't she?
Oh, definitely. Mount Kanchenjunga is this vast, indifferent presence overlooking the human mess. Cho-Oyu itself, the decaying house, is the decaying colonial legacy. Bijou's broken biscuit tin becomes the symbol of his shattered dreams.
And the descriptions, the imagery.
So vivid. You get the damp, green, misty Himalayas contrasted with the hot, greasy, cockroach-infested New York basements. It really grounds you in the sensory experience of each place, highlighting the displacement.
There's a lot of irony, too.
Yeah. Lodes. The judge's whole life, trying to become English only to end up isolated. The title itself. Bijou seeking the land of the free and finding a kind of prison. And she uses juxtaposition constantly, beauty and cruelty, wealth and poverty, humor and tragedy, all side by side, reflecting life's messiness.
Let's touch on a quote. Tsai's thought, could fulfillment ever be felt as deeply as loss? Love was the ache, the anticipation, the retreat. What does that capture?
It really captures that pervasive sense of yearning in the book, the idea that maybe longing, the lack of something, is a more powerful defining human emotion than actual contentment. It's quite a romantic but also sad thought.
And Bijou's thought just simply, here's another country that doesn't want me.
So stark, so brutal, it just perfectly encapsulates that feeling of perpetual rejection that marked the immigrant experience for so many, the feeling of being unwanted everywhere.
When you put it all together, the characters, the plot, the themes, the style de Tsai really forces you to confront some uncomfortable truths, doesn't she? About privilege, power, the hidden costs of globalization.
Absolutely. It makes you see the interconnectedness, how suffering in one part of the world might underpin comfort in another. It challenges easy assumptions.
It's definitely a book that stays with you. And maybe the final question it leaves you mulling over is, can we ever truly escape the history we inherit? And how do we find dignity when the world seems set up to take it away?
It's a powerful testament, I think, to human resilience, even if it's a quiet, bruised kind of resilience. It shows that even when loss feels overwhelming, that capacity for connection somehow endures.
A reminder that even in shared brokenness, there could be a profound, if fragile, bond. A truly unforgettable read.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.